Well, thanks for coming out tonight. We're going to be in the book of John. I hope to kind of wrap up the concept. We're kind of just doing an overview of John. I wanted to do it last week completely. I didn't feel like I finished it. So I want to cover a few things about this, and then hopefully next week we'll get into kind of beginning the survey, or just called the life of Christ, and just kind of go through and put all the Gospels together and kind of do more of the historical account. I do want to go, if you don't mind, please, go to 3 John, because, again, this is kind of something that I was thinking about last week, and as we, you know, after we got done talking about this, and I think you've got to decide if you can hear this attitude or this voice in the book of John. John is writing the book of John around 85 A.D. Peter's dead, Paul's dead. Paul ends his ministry saying, everyone in Asia has deserted me. He lists several people in his ministry team that had gone away. Peter writes 2 Peter, 64 A.D., warning about the false teachers. There's false teachers are moving in among you, and they're there to take over, and they're there to corrupt the people and take advantage of them. So, and there he's talking about not the pagan world. He's talking about the church. Paul's talking about the church. Everyone in Asia has deserted him. He's not talking about, the Gentile governments. He's talking about the churches that he started has deserted him. Now, that'd be 64 A.D. That would be 67 A.D. John's writing, 20 years later, the book of John, and he's writing, I'm in 3 John right now, looking at 3 John verse 9. And this is him writing to Gaius, a man that is in this, we don't know what church it is, but it's in Asia Minor somewhere. John's familiar with the church. Paul may have started the church. We don't know for sure. It's just one of those churches. But Gaius is a member, but someone else has taken over the church. Let's just say a pastor, I guess, of some sort. In verse 9, John writes to Gaius, who's a member of the church. He writes in verse 9, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to be first, will have nothing to do with us. So if I come, I will call attention to what he is doing, gossiping maliciously about us. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. And the brothers would be the teachers and men that John sends to the church to help teach them, strengthen them, keep them in the apostolic doctrine, share about Christ. So this is John, the apostle of Jesus Christ, who walked with Jesus, who was at the cross, who saw Jesus after the resurrection, saw Jesus ascend into heaven, was there on the day of Pentecost. Now someone has taken over his church and is blaspheming John, saying he don't know what he's talking about. So John tries to send teachers up that he's trained, and the church won't have anything to do with them. And now he's writing to Gaius, who's still in the church, and he's kind of warning him, be careful, because if he finds out you're being, you're giving these guys housing, if you're reading my letters, you'll get kicked out too. Not satisfied with that, he refuses to welcome the brothers. He also stops those who want to do so, meaning who want to accept the apostolic teaching, and puts them out of the church. Dear friend, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. Okay, that's 85 A.D., and that is John writing in 85 A.D. to a believer who's in a church whose pastor won't have anything to do with John or anybody coming out of John's church. So Paul ends in 60, or Peter ends in 64 A.D., having just finished 2 Peter, warning the church about false. His last book is all about false teachers. Look out. I mean, they're confusing you. Paul writes in 2 Timothy to Timothy, naming at least 4 individuals who have deserted him and left him, and then says, everyone in Asia has deserted me. He talks about no one came on when he stood before Nero on his defense this time, no one from the church leadership stepped up with him, because if they did, they would have been killed. So Paul is in front of Nero. No Roman support. In the end of Acts, the church came to welcome Paul. They came to visit Paul. The church was accepted. But that was earlier. That was before 64 when Nero began to persecute Christians. We're going back to 60, 62. The Christians had room to move around. Paul was welcome. He was released. But by 67, no one in Rome even, he says, no one came to my support. May it not be held against him. Again, I'm way off subject here. But understand, Paul understood why the church and the leadership in Rome, when Paul was put on trial, they kind of like stepped back, because it would have just been like putting their head on the cutting block. It's like, I'm on Paul's side. So they just, he says, may it not be held against him. I don't blame him. Why just come forward to be slaughtered? But when you start talking about other situations, talk about the false teachers, talking about those who deserted him in Asia, the churches who turned their backs on him, weren't teaching his doctrine anymore, or John, these guys are, in a sense, calling down curses on him, saying, you know, God will judge them. God will judge them for what they've done. You understand there's a place where I understand why you're in hiding. There's also a place where I know, like when John's saying, he won't let us in the church. And it's not because of persecution. It's like he wants to be first. He wants it his own way. So, with that attitude, what I'm trying to say this, and as I'm going to show you some things in the book of John. Try to understand John. We know John as the apostle of love. John was the apostle of love, for God so loved the world, okay? And he talks about they'll know us by our love. So John is the apostle of love. And all of a sudden, in our culture, the apostle of love is like just smiling. He's nice. He's peaceful. It's all just get along. It's all hold hands. And this is this right here, this love, for God so loved the world. We're going to find out here. I'm going to read some verses to you again. The world is going to be identified in the beginning of John. Jews are going to be identified early in the book of John, and just the average, you know, the average person, just the world itself, or just people in general. Well, we'll see this, and all of them. There is basically no hope here. There's no light here. They can't even recognize God's love. He's not talking about love down here. He's talking about God being love and reaching into this circle and trying to help people. And what you're going to see in the book of John is groups reject this love, but there's going to be a few individuals. And throughout the book, he's going to use words like receive, believe in Jesus' name. There's going to be individuals who are going to come out and be delivered through the love of God who's reaching in here. It's not us. I mean, we emulate this love. We receive this love. But the love that John is talking about is God's love for this mess. Anytime John talks about this mess, you watch it. He's not impressed. He's not impressed with the world. He's not impressed with the Jews. He's not impressed with the people he meets. Every one of them is rejecting the truth. They've got their own agenda. And so, remember, this is the John who, when they were... Here's a map real quickly. We'll eventually get to this. Here's Galilee. Here's Jordan. Here's the Sea of Galilee. Jesus and his disciples were up in Galilee. They were going to go down to Judea, but they had to pass through Samaria. Now, they did that at different times. He met a Samaritan woman. But Jesus, because there's so many people following him, had such a large, in a sense, ministry, that they sent people ahead to kind of make hotel reservations, you know, get rest stops, you know, align food. We're going to be coming through. Here's your city ready. Rag Bry's coming. Are you ready for it? You know? And when they went down, they came back and says, they said, no, we don't want Rag Bry coming through our city. Go around. You understand what I'm saying? Because it wasn't just Jesus and Peter and John who just walking by. Who are you guys? When Jesus came to town, by the time he's going down to Jerusalem for his crucifixion, everybody knows who Jesus. The whole city came out to greet him because this is him. This is whatever who's everybody's talking about. Jesus couldn't just go into McDonald's and order a sandwich. I mean, someone had to go get it for him and bring it back, if you don't understand what I'm saying. I mean, you get the idea. So when he sent someone down here into Samaria, and they came back and says, no, go around, Jesus says, okay, we'll go around. And so they went over to this side, and they came down on this side of the Jordan River and came in up through Jericho. And that's where you can hear that, read those accounts. But remember, they came back and says, no, the Samaritans won't let you through. You remember what John and his brother James said? Do you remember what they said? Now, this is your apostle of love. I'm just building you a character right here. John, when they came back, says, they won't let us come through. John turned to Jesus, you want us to call down fire out of heaven and just burn them up? That's the John. And John and James, Jesus called them, remember, sons of thunder. Why? It's like, John, take a chill pill. Just relax. I mean, you've got to think. Jesus looked at John and James and was like, and you guys are wound tight. I mean, and so this is, until you've got to get this idea in your mind that John wasn't this passive wallflower that was a hippie that just like, hey, we can all just get along. He's wanting to call down. In Jesus, after 3 years of being with Jesus in ministry, John's solution to the problem. This is called problem-solving skills. We try and teach kids in school that problem-solving skills, be critical thinkers. After spending 3 years with Jesus in ministry, John, what do you think we ought to do? Well, here's what I think. I think we ought to just call down fire like Elijah, just burn up Samaria, just leave a big hole in the ground like Sodom and Gomorrah. That's my thought. What do you think, James? I'm right with you. Jesus laughs and says, you sons of thunder. And let's walk around. It's like, you understand. So, I mean, this is John. So when we read John in 85 AD, being the last apostle alive, because the others have been killed, many of them rejected by the church, and he's writing 3 John, he can't even get into one of his churches. He can't even send teachers into one of his churches. He's being, not just they can't get in, they're blaspheming John. They're accusing John of something, making it publicly, nullifying his ministry. And also remember, that's before he ends up on the Isle of Patmos as a political enemy. And then he's released from that. And then if you read the book of Revelation, remember, it's inspired by God. It's the Spirit of God. It's Jesus bringing a message. It's prophecy. But it's the words of John. It's his vocabulary. It's his him describing what he saw. And it's some ugly stuff. I mean, it's not like some bedtime story you read to your children. It's ugly stuff. And so with that being said, I want to go to John chapter 1 again. And as we look at this, I think one way of approaching the book of John, there's a very, obviously, a very, very positive side to the book of John. For God so loved the world, God's going to send His Spirit. And we see, if you receive Jesus, if you believe on His name, there's always this call of hope. There's always this offer of salvation. But as far as John's attitude to his crowd that he's ministering to, there's not much here to work with. Here we go, right here. And I've got right here, if you look in chapter 1, verse 4. Jesus Christ in chapter 1, Jesus Christ can't be described any greater. I mean, he is described as the cosmic king, the light of the universe. He's life himself. You can't describe Jesus with any more glory than John does. Jesus is eternity. He is the man. But you get down to verse 4. In Him, Jesus, the Word, was life, and that life was the light of men. I mean, this is your hope, folks. The light shined into the darkness, but the darkness has not understood. It's like he creates this great picture of the light, of the Word, of Jesus, the Son of God, coming, and it shines in this darkness, but the darkness, no clue. There's no hope down here. Up here's great hope. Down here where we are at, It hasn't understood a thing. It can't even perceive what I'm talking about. John basically presents a great hope in a very hopeless situation. Here's the hope, but you have no hope. You can't even see it. Now we continue going on as we continue into verse 10. He was in the world, though the world was made through him, the world did not recognize him. Okay, so now here's the world, didn't see him. He came to that which was his own. And I think that's referring to the Jewish people. All the prophets talked about this light, this person, this Christ, the one sent by God. Many of the prophets spoke to him as the second member of the Trinity when he appeared as the angel or the messenger of the Lord. Moses did. Joshua did. David saw him. Adam spoke with the Lord. Now, when Adam's walking with the Lord in the Garden of Eden, who's he walking with? He's walking with the Son of God. He's walking with the second member of the Trinity. He's walking with the one, the Word, who communicates to mankind. So it's the same person. It's not Jesus Christ the man, but it is the same person who is in the form of eternal God coming and walking and communicating. It says, so now it says, he came to that which was his own. All the prophets spoke about him. And now he comes to the Jewish people, but his own did not receive him. Yet to so right there, the world, the people, even the Jews themselves who had the scriptures, he walks in on them. Here I am. No, you're not. It's like this place down here, it's hopeless. So, I mean, guess what I'm pointing at? John, and again, I don't want to overspeak this, but you realize that John understood the light, John the apostle. He lived with him. He walked with him. He heard him speak. He watched him die. He was there after the resurrection. He saw him ascend. So John understands these things, but he also saw the Jews reject him. He saw people reject him. He saw Judas betray him. He saw the light die on the cross. He saw just disaster after disaster. He watched his brother James get beheaded. He watched Paul's dead. Peter's dead. The churches are rejecting him. Now it's 85 AD. It's like, my gosh, it's just been one disaster after another. This is the light. Is anybody interested? No one's interested. And now it's 85 AD, and he's writing his gospel. And you've got to, if you can think of it this way, I'm trying to think of a good word to use for it. Think of someone who's brokenhearted. It's like who's hopeless, who's disillusioned with the message. And again, he is an apostle. He knows the truth. He understands who Jesus Christ is. Jesus is breathing, his spirit is breathing the scripture through John. But John is looking at the situation and says, you guys do know we're working with a hopeless situation here. The churches are rejecting me. The Jews rejected Jesus Christ himself. The world is falling apart. And so as he writes this, I mean, if anyone is going to be disillusioned, John is, but yet he's not. He understands, I use the word disillusioned in too harsh of a sense, he knows the world is hopeless. But he's got great hope in this. And that's why he keeps talking about, well, let's look at some of the notes now. If you go to your framework book, page 182. I'm going to go back to page 181 in a moment. But on top of page 182, into this hopeless world that we all come from, I mean, it hasn't changed. I mean, it's the same world. We're the same people. The light is still as bright. The light is still as full of hope as it ever been. This is the light. But now, right here, in this dark world, these are the words, which is interesting. All the way through the book of John, these are words that are used. The concept of faith or belief in Jesus is equated with these words. In other words, in this situation, if you can hear this, if you can understand this, if you will receive this message, this hopeless condition that you are in, don't look for hope in the world. Don't look for a group of people to join in. We'll all rally together. The Tower of Babel is not going to save you. A group is not going to deliver you. There is no answer here. The answers here will always end up rebelling against the light. Your only hope is to pull out of this circle and to embrace this light. Well, here's the words. In chapter 1, verse 12, receive him. 140, follow him. 413, drink him. 451, responding. 657, eating the bread of life. 660, accepting. 938, worshiping. 1139, obeying. 1210, committing. Those are all individual responses of pulling out of this. And that's when you read the book of John, he's saying, I've written these things, and we talked last week, he wrote about seven signs that you individually might know that Jesus is the Son of God. Because if you're looking to some religious group or some Jewish organization or some friend or some down in here, it's going to spiral out of control. Are you sure, John? That's kind of, or you know, maybe me, I'm the one saying it. But it's like John has seen Judas betray Jesus. He's seen the very people that Jesus came to betray him. He's seen churches that embrace it, spin off and follow some false doctrine. There's nothing stable in this world. It is only going to be this light. Now, with that being said, I'm going to try to go through these things. Look down at the bottom of the page, of page 182, and there are six conflicts between the Jews and Jesus that are recorded by John. And I'll go through those here in a little bit. Chapter 2, verses 18 through 20, at the first Passover. Jesus goes through the first Passover and meets the Jewish crowd, and there's a conflict. 5:16 through 47, goes to the second Passover, meets the Jewish leaders, there's a conflict. In 6:41 through 59, we talked about that last week, that's where he feeds them bread, and the only thing they can understand is, we want more bread. And there's a conflict. Now, do realize if we would, and I'll build this a better case later on, but that's, he feeds the 5,000 Jews at one point in his ministry, and they reject him. He comes back, and then he feeds 4,000, and there's a completely different response. Now, and we'll see it in the text. These were the Jews who rejected him. Then he goes and talks to the Canaanite woman. Remember, we talked about that. She's out, you know, even the children get the crumbs that fall from the dogs get the crumbs that fall from the children's table. the children had rejected Jesus, and he says, "You've got great faith." He turns, by the time he enters back into Israel, there's a group of, now listen, he feeds 4,000 upon his return. But it's pretty clear in the text, if you read it and put it all together, these aren't Jews. You know who those are? Those are Gentiles who followed him out of Gentile territory into Jerusalem. This is tension right here. This 4,000 is Gentiles who are receiving him, accepting him. It's like, and they won't go. They made it for 3 days. They won't go away. Give us more. He said, we got to feed these people. So it's a different thing. This was a sign to the Jews, and they rejected it. This right here, the 4,000, we just keep getting further and further away from their homes, and they just keep following him into Israel. It's like, what are we going to do with these people? So these are Jews that reject him. These are Gentiles who received him. Kind of interesting. This is not in John. You can see that 4,000 in the book of Matthew. There's two different crowds, the 5,000 and the 4,000. We'll talk more about that later on. Chapter 7 is the Feast of Tabernacles, and I'll tell you that real quickly. That the second Passover, there's possibly four Passovers. I want to explain that to you here also. But after one of the Passovers in April, in chapter 7, verse 15, that would be October 15th, it's the Feast of Tabernacles, Jesus goes down to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles and has a confrontation with the Jews. Then in 831, between October 15th and December 25th, he has another confrontation while he's still hanging around waiting for this. I've got to write this down I'm rambling here. Let's go with John 7, John 8, and John 10. And there's the references are there in your book, the bottom three. This is October 13th or 15th. It's the Feast of Tabernacles. Jesus has gone, he's in Jerusalem. He then in chapter 8, it's between October 15th and December 25th. December 25th is the Feast of Lights, or we call it a dedication, I guess I should say, but Hanukkah. It's also called the Feast of Dedication, John describes it. So this is October, November, December. Jesus has a conflict, and then verse 8:31, that's between those dates, and you see that would be, it's 29 A.D. potentially, but that event is taking place between here. So you've got April, a Passover, October, Tabernacles, you've got this verse, chapter 8, which is between October and December, and December 25th, conflict right here. And then by that time, it's April again, and now you're at the crucifixion. So what you have right there, John records 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and that does not include the crucifixion. Those are the conflicts with Jesus and the Jews and their religious leaders. In other words, my whole point here, I think, is to point out that John was going out of his way to show you the Jews did not understand. They rejected. Anytime Jesus made a presentation, they shut him down. If it was at a Passover, if it was at the feast, if it was out in the wilderness, or not wilderness, but he's feeding the crowd. But you go up now, above that, he's got seven personal interviews with Jesus that are recorded by John. And you guys are familiar with these. I'd like to go through them with you. But every one of these ends up with some kind of a positive interaction. Again, when he's interacting with the Jews, they rail against him. They accuse him. But now, Nicodemus comes to him at night in chapter 3. That's where you have, for God so loved the world, to have that whole thing. Nicodemus was an individual who spun out of this group and came over with individual faith and says, okay, we know you're sent from God. We just don't know where to put you. And Jesus accepted him and began to talk to them and led him to a greater understanding. And we can talk about that. Then he goes up through Samaria and meets the woman at the well. Again, he's talking to a woman in Samaria at a well. And you know how ridiculous that whole scenario is. But she places faith, and she's not even, in a sense, a good Jewish girl. She's not even a good Samaritan girl. She's got, you know, all these husband issues and stuff, and she's out at the well during the noon hour, and it's like, and Jesus leads her, and she goes back and brings a message of faith to the city, and the whole city comes out. She says, they told us about you. The whole city comes out. So notice when one woman responds, a city follows her out. The nobleman in Cana, we'll talk about that. The paralytic at the pool of Bethesda. the blind men in Jerusalem, which is a great story. That causes all kinds of problems during these chapters right here, because while Jesus is having a confrontation with the Jewish leadership, a blind man gets healed and starts, in a sense, witnessing and teaching the scribes and the priests. They get really upset with him. And then Mary in Bethany and Martha in Bethany. Those are the seven, in a sense, personal interviews where Jesus is talking to an individual and they've come to faith. It's not a smooth road. It's not like a real easy come to the altar, bow your head, say a prayer, and now you're saved, you go to heaven. It's attention, like Nicodemus and Jesus. Like Nicodemus is not understanding these things. Jesus even challenged him. He says, "You don't know what I mean when I say the Spirit." It's like, "No, I don't understand what you mean when you say born again. What are you talking about?" So Jesus is dropping these things, and Nicodemus is like, "I'm trying to understand." The woman at the well, Jesus explains it to her, but in terms where she's like really struggling all the way through those were rough interactions, but the people are looking for the truth. My point for showing you those is there are seven personal interviews where the people respond positively towards Jesus, but John also throughout those has six interactions, not counting the crucifixion account, which is another interesting thing. So you say seven if you wanted to, where the Jews completely reject Jesus and don't understand who he is. Now, go back a page. And let me see if I can explain this. And this is debatable. And I would like to look at these verses right now, where it says there are four Passovers in the book of John. Now, if we were to understand again, this is worthy debating. But I'm going to say the crucifixion was 30 A.D. Okay. Another good date is 33 A.D., but we'll just say A.D. This is, Jesus was crucified at his fourth Passover. Not of his life, but of his ministry. And then we're going to go back to 29, 28, and 27, with Jesus beginning his ministry right around 26, you know, where John baptized him in 26 A.D., and then he's going to come into April, will be the Passover, first of Nisan, And this would be his first Passover. Then there's going to be a second Passover, and there's going to be potentially a third Passover. And that kind of, it doesn't mean 4 years. It means this is the beginning of the first year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, and it ends with this Passover. And now, that just kind of helps you understand where these things are taking place. So if you would, go to John chapter 2, verse 23. John chapter 2, verse 23. And this is also, if you look there on that back page, the conflicts with the Jews, this is the first conflict he has with the Jews. And I'll begin, let's say in verse 13. We're going to go into more detail when we start going through the life of Christ. In chapter 1, you've got Jesus being baptized, Jesus hanging out and talking with Peter and John and these guys before he calls them. There is this understanding, and I've heard it taught so many times, that you've just got to follow Jesus by faith like Peter and John did. Jesus just came up, they're walking on the shore one day, and they're at work. He says, "Follow me." And they just threw their nets down and followed Jesus. That's faith. It's like, you know, that's not what happened. They meet Jesus down in Judea during John's ministry. They had lunch with Jesus. They traveled with Jesus. They went to the wedding of Cana with Jesus. He turned water to wine in front of them. They had to go back to work. And then several weeks, months later, Jesus comes by after having been with them for different situations, come by and says, "Okay, it's time. Let's get this going." And they dropped their nets and they followed him. They weren't following a stranger. They were following someone that they'd built, they'd already tested. They'd sat with at lunch. They'd stayed with him. They'd traveled with him. They'd asked him questions. He taught them. And then finally, they were convinced. He'd already turned his water to wine to show them, "I am he." And then later on, he calls someone. They say, "Well, you just got to, you know, I'll make you fishers of men. Come follow Jesus." Like, wait, who are you? And what are you talking about? They had information. So understand, we'll go through all of that, you know, chapter 1. So as we go through this, we're into chapter 2, verse 13. So we've gone through some of those from 26 up to 27 A.D. We've had a few months here already. Verse 13, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple courts, he found men selling cattle, sheep, and doves, and others sitting at tables exchanging money. I mean, this is how he goes into the temple. This is Jesus beginning his public ministry. He's already got people following. He's already done some teaching. And now he shows up in the temple and very, very unchristian, very unchristlike. He made a whip out of cords and drove all from the temple area, both sheep and cattle. And again, someone's pointed this out once before to me, was he made a whip out of cords. The idea is there, he didn't just go, what is going on, and flip out. He saw this, sat down, got some rope, and had to make a whip. He had to weave together, he made a whip. He put a whip together, didn't carry one with him or find a whip. He had to sit down and, on purpose, design some kind of a weapon and say, this will work, now I'm going to clean house. And then it wasn't a temper tantrum, it was something that he was doing. Anyway, you can think about that. Drove all of the temple area, both sheep and cattle. That's called a stampede. Maybe terrorism, a riot, all kinds of ugly words for it. He scattered the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. He starts a stampede, opens their cash registers up and throws the money all over and starts turning over tables. Now, again, this is not some kind of wallflower, pansy Jesus. This is a man who can shut down, think Friday, Black Friday. He can shut down the mall on Black Friday, and everyone just stands back against the wall and goes, whoa, there's a madman in town. And he does these things. And then he doesn't just do all those things. He then begins to preach. After everyone stops, he goes, well, I'm here to tell you something. He's speaking like a prophet. To those who sold doves, he says, get these out of here. How dare you turn my father's house into a market? Now, those were words they were not familiar with. Your father's house. Whoa, the theological ramifications of that statement means this guy's got some things we need to find out about. Either he's crazy, he's a lunatic, or maybe we should go back and check out some scripture. His disciples, remember that it was written, zeal for your house will consume me. And that's how they said right there, that was God's or Jesus' zeal for God the Father's house, the temple. Then the Jews demanded of him a miraculous sign. What miraculous sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this? You've just come in here like Jeremiah or somebody, and who do you think you are? You better have God's backing. Give us some kind of a sign. He goes, okay. He says, destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days. Now, again, Jesus talking in, and this is something you got to keep in mind. Sometimes you think, I'm so dumb. I don't understand these things. What does he mean, destroy this temple in 3 days? How's it? I think you need to give yourself some room because Jesus, it says in Matthew, when he was in a state of confrontation, when he was being rejected, he spoke the truth, but he spoke it in parables. So those who were rejecting him had no idea. What are you saying? I know you have no idea what I'm saying. I'm speaking truth, but I'm saying it in a way that you can't even put it together. Now, I'm not being insulting to you. I'm just saying Jesus is speaking in codes. He's not saying you're going to crucify me and after 3 days I'm going to come back to life. They say, what gives you the right to do this in the temple courts? I tell you what, he says, you tear this temple, you destroy this temple, I'll bring it back in 3 days. What? And now they're going to go off talking about the buildings. And that's exactly, I think, what Jesus wants. Get distracted by that and miss the point that I am the sign. I am going to show you that I am the Son of God. I'm going to come back from the dead after you crucify me. And again, it says right here, the Jews replied, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you're going to raise it in 3 days? I mean, it took the Romans longer than that to tear it down. But the temple he had spoken of was his body. After he was raised from the dead, his disciples recalled what he had said. Then they believed the scripture and the words that Jesus spoke. In other words, that day that Jesus says, destroy this temple and in 3 days I'll rise again, no one understood it. The disciples, after the resurrection, say, do you remember how confused you were when he cleared the temple? He says, in 3 days I'll build the temple. He wasn't talking about the temple. He was talking about himself, the temple. He was going to rebuild it. And he's going to call himself the temple. So again, he's speaking truth, but he's speaking in a way that people aren't going to understand it. He says, he tells in Matthew, it says, I speak to them in parables, so hearing, they will not hear. Though hearing, they will not understand. Okay, I'll read verse 23. Now, while he was in Jerusalem at the Passover feast, that's this first one, many people saw the miraculous signs he was doing. So he's doing some miraculous signs. and believed in his name. So again, there are those who are coming, they're seeing what he's doing, and they're coming over to him. But Jesus, now here's another one of those, watch this verse, I tell you, I think John is, I don't want to use the word disillusioned in a bad way, but I think John has come to grips with the fact that this is an ugly world. And he puts it right here again. Many people saw the miraculous signs, they believed in his name. So what did Jesus think about this? Well, I remember he wasn't impressed. Because it says right here, but Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. It's like, John, listen, they're following me today, but they'll forget about it by tomorrow. It will not last. Remember the children in the wilderness? Jesus has been with people for, you know, thousands of years. He's the one who gave them manna in the wilderness. He's the one who, the 10 plagues, and led them out of Egypt. As soon as they got out there and ran out of water, what did they do? They wanted to go back to Egypt. It's like, he did 10 miracles and got them out of the land of Egypt. And as soon as they hit the desert, they go, we hate this. We want to go back. So now he's doing miracles and many believe on him. And he can just imagine, they say, well, this is really going good, isn't it? It's like, no, don't be impressed. And John records, he says, I remember, he says, Jesus would not entrust himself to them, for he knew all men. They're fickle. They're going to change their mind as soon as things get difficult. And that is one reason why I think persecution is such an important factor of the Christian life, is you've got to make, it's easy when you're having your best life now. Everybody wants to be a Christian. But now we're going to line up and start cutting your heads off. It's like, well, nah, you know, I could go either way. It's not that big a deal if you want us to worship on Thursdays or Fridays. It's not, you know, as long as we all just get along and we are all tolerant of each other. I'm really all about love and coexisting. Right, that's not Christianity, so let's either coexist or get your head cut off. So Jesus was, he says, for he knew all men. He did not need man's testimony about man, for he knew what was in a man. Another negative verse about mankind. I mean, there's some people following, but he's not impressed. Okay, let's go now to John 5:1. Again, what I'm pointing out here is the great hope and provision Jesus Christ is offering. But yet, as John records this great light, this life that's available, he's also looking at every situation going, yeah, don't be impressed. He fed 5,000, but 5,000 are going to reject him. He did miracles, many came to believe, but Jesus wasn't impressed. Jesus was never impressed with the crowd. Chapter 5, verse 1. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for a feast of the Jews. And that is, it doesn't say specifically, but it times outright, and that would be right here, the second. This is 28 AD. Now there was in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool with the Aramaic, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda. That's just north of the Temple Mount. There's been a pool there since Abraham's day, just north of Mount Moriah. It eventually became a pool, and they eventually used to water sheep there back when there was an agricultural, you know, outside of the city. But by Jesus' day, there was a colonnade built around it. Now, what's interesting, John is going to record these colonnades here, the five colonnades, which are sidewalks with columns with a roof covering on them, covered sidewalks. And the way John describes it is, well, let me do it real quickly, something like this, and this is sloppy. But there's five of them all together. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like this. And these are colored, and that's a very sloppy way of doing it. And no one had seen that. They recorded it in the Gospels right here. And the Crusaders and people had built stuff around it as a holy site. But when archaeology started excavating in the 1800s, they found the remains of the pool was divided into two pools with the five colonnades. And it was one of those proofs that the book of John was definitely an eyewitness account. Well, there it is right there in verse 2. Now there was in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people would lie. Anyway, that is while he's in town for the second potential. It says the Jewish feast, the second one. Next one, verse 29. Now you can see right here how that's kind of shaky. That is like, well, are you sure? Why has that got to be a Passover? It doesn't have to be, but the timing would work out. So, I mean, that doesn't say specifically, so there's room to say, throw up a red flag and question that. Chapter 6, verse 4. Now, this is where we get into, we read this last week, this is where Jesus is going to feed the 4,000, the 5,000 Jews. And you can see in chapter 6, verse 4, I'm going to begin chapter 6, verse 1. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is the Sea of Tiberias, and a great crowd of people, Jewish people, followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. Then Jesus went up on the mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. Now this is, I think, the third. It is not the fourth. It is not the one that he's crucified at. We are now, at this point in the book of John, we're 12 months away from his crucifixion. Now, all of this can be debated. You see, you understand what I'm saying? You could make this the fourth. You could say this is actually, you know, or say there's no fourth. This is just the last one and combine these two. But I think it works better, especially with all the text that we've got here. This is the third one. When Jesus looked and saw the great crowd, where should we buy bread for these people? He gives them that. He asked him to test his disciples. There's that. Then he's going to do something similar to that with the Gentiles later. And then chapter 12, verse 1, is what I'm going to say is the fourth. And this is the one everybody's familiar with. Chapter 12, verse 1. This would be a year after this. Again, we understand we're still counting just 3 years. This is the beginning of his ministry. Then 1 year, 2 years, and 3 years. So it's, you know, it's not 36 months, but say 42 months or 38 months or something. Chapter 12, verse 1, and this is pretty clear. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany, where Lazarus lived, and whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So Lazarus has already been raised from the dead, and that goes back to that time period between, when I read that before to you, there's October 15th, December 25th, those holidays, those Jewish feasts are mentioned between 29, the fall of 29, and the winter of 30 AD coming up in April. We've already talked about that. And so Lazarus would have been raised right here in that time period, going back in the book of John. And so now he's back in Bethany on the Mount of Olives, and he's eating with Lazarus, who's been raised from the dead. And again, it's... So we could see some great things right here. Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. When we talk about story time, you've got Lazarus who's there at the table, and Mary's serving. Lazarus has been raised from the dead. Then Mary took about a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of perfume. Now, the thing that Mary is going to be commended for right here is the fact that it appears, and this is worth noting, it appears she understands what's about to go down in Jerusalem at this time. I mean, because Jesus is going to say it. Verse 4, but one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? What a great cover. We care about people. We care about people. It's like, and Jesus, again, be careful. Jesus knows that he is the light of the world. He knows who he is. Your only hope is in Jesus. Your hope is not in, we just want to love people. Your hope is in Jesus, and he'll empower you to do something. But if your hope is in, we're just all going to get together and help people and leave Jesus behind, well, just watch Jesus. I mean, this is some crazy verses right here. But one of the disciples, Jesus Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. Now, you tell me, what would Christ do? Would he just pour that out and waste that money? Or would he sell it and give the money to the poor? The good Christian thing to do would be to do what? Sell it and feed people with it. That's what Christ would have you do. And Judas. He did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. So in other words, right there, that's John now saying, don't be impressed. When someone rises up out of the sewer of humanity and says, I care about people, don't be impressed. There's a motive. And Judas's motive, he says, I know. He was a thief. He was stealing from the ministry and doing what he wanted to with the money. And now he's just trying to replace the money and get more money in the bank. He's using, let's feed the poor, take care of the homeless, for his own motivation. Here's Jesus' response. He says to Judas, leave her alone. It was intended that she should save this perfume for the day of my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me. Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only to see him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. You know, sightseers. They were going to come out here and see the celebrities. So the chief priest made plans to kill Lazarus as well. For an account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. And John, of course, throughout this, just continues to paint this very bleak picture of people, even the people involved in Jesus' ministry. So, what I just showed you was the four potential Passovers that are broken down in the book of John. And that's going to come up later when we start putting all these things together. Now, with that being said, let's see if we can... I could go on this more and go back and read some more verses. Just go back and look on page 182. During all those times, you're going to have those, like I said, those interviews where Jesus is going to stop and talk. And the conversation, he's talked to thousands of people. But there are seven personal interviews where Jesus talks to Nicodemus, the woman of Samaria, the nobleman of Cana, the paralytic at the pool of Bethesda, the blind man in Jerusalem, which is another great story, Mary and Martha. And there's insights that every one of those became a believer or was becoming a believer or was getting things clarified. And Jesus is explaining things. And John stops and details those conversations. But at the same time, whenever the Jews meet Jesus, there's always a conflict because they're not interested in receiving and understanding him. Okay, on page 183, that kind of, in a sense, sums up the book of John. I mean, there's more that you could obviously do with it. I'm not painting this off as a negative book by any means, but I'm trying to correct the concept of John, the apostle of love, and all the good things in the book of John. The good things in the book of John are Jesus, the light of the world, eternal God who's become man. The negative side about it is man fails from the beginning. The world did not recognize him. His people didn't recognize him. Those who came to believe in him, they betrayed him. Even his own disciples stole from him and then betrayed him. Jesus wouldn't trust himself to men. He knew men were losers. There's nothing, they can't do anything for me. I'm here to help them. Men don't have love. God has love for men and is trying to save them. And they're not going to come as groups. They're going to come as individuals who will finally separate themselves from this sewer of humanity and come to Jesus Christ for salvation. And it's like, well, you think John's seen that? Well, I think John has seen the sewer of humanity from the Jews who betrayed Jesus, who crucified Jesus, to the churches who were betraying him, to the Gentiles who killed Peter and killed Paul. All of his friends are being slaughtered, and now he's an old man, and he's got a churches that he's trying to be responsible for, and they won't have anything to do with him. It's kind of like, no, does he have a bad attitude? I'm not saying he's got a bad attitude, but he definitely knows there's nothing man can do for you. You need Jesus Christ. And that's why he's giving you seven signs, seven things that you can believe, that you can have faith in Christ and separate yourself from this mess. Okay, page 183. There's a map that shows you, again, where many of the stories are the places that take place in the Gospels. Turn the next page. You're going to want to look on page 184 and 185 together. And this was something that impressed me when I went to Jerusalem for the first time. I wrote the book Jerusalem, you know, and took all the pictures and I got. But in 2006, 2007, I had no idea. I knew you could go to Jerusalem and visit some holy sites, but it's like you can go to West Bend and see the Grotto too. I mean, I've been there. And that's cool. I like the rocks. But it's like I'm not going to go all the way to Jerusalem to see the Grotto, you see. I mean, and buy a crucifix at some store. It's like, never mind. I'll stay home and mow my yard. But I ended up going. And when I got there, it's like, oh my gosh. These aren't holy sites. These are archaeological sites. This is history. Now I'm interested. And what I found here, and this was just something I put together. The pictures you see on the right page are numbered. 1, 2, you see those numbered right there. And over on the left page, the map, that is Jerusalem from 30 AD. And you can see, like number 1, that is the base stones of the northwest corner of the Temple Mount, and that's Fort Antoniah is on the other side. The remains of Fort Antoniah are on the other side. That's where Paul was taken to. That's where Jesus was taken to. And you can see Fort Antoniah. That's named by Herod, built it, named it after Mark Antony, his friend, Fort Antoniah. Number 2, and that's the Pool of Bethesda, to the top right of the page, number 2, Pool of Bethesda. You can see the two pools there. It's the sheep pool. going, you can go back into the Old Testament, there was water there. It's a natural source of water. It was just the pool where the shepherds would bring their sheep and they'd water their sheep there. Eventually, it was close enough to the city that they used it and made it into a reservoir. There is the remains of some of those walls that were part of the Pool of Bethesda. Again, it's like, you're kidding me. I didn't know this was still here. You go to number three, I guess that's not number there. That's a tree on the Mount of Olives in the Garden of Gethsemane. And do realize that tree is 1,000, 1,500, some want to say 2,000 years old. They're ancient, ancient trees. But you got to be careful because they're probably not trees from when Jesus was there. Although they could be that old. The Romans, when they came in and destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD, they sawed all the trees down, laid it bare, and used them for building siege equipment, you know, war machines, or for fuel for their fires. And so there's no trees in the Garden of Gethsemane. They say, well, this is where Jesus prayed, we'll spare this tree. They would have sawed it down and burnt it up or turned it into some kind of a siege engine. But again, they could be sprouts, they could be, you know, roots that have regrown or whatever. But either way, those trees in the Garden of Gethsemane are 1,000, 1,500, sometimes pushing 2,000 years old. They're ancient trees. It's kind of hard to say this tree was here when Jesus was here because Jesus was here in 30 AD and the Romans were here in 70 AD and the Romans cut everything down. So again, that's, you know, it's not a big deal. Four, I'm standing right there. Again, obviously the temple's no longer there. But if the temple was where it is on this map, where Rittmeyer and others say it should be, I'm standing right there about where the altar would be, looking east at the Mount of Olives. I'm looking over from the temple courts, over the Kidron Valley, at the Mount of Olives right there. And in a bigger picture, you see the sun is just coming up, so it's all kind of cool with light rays and stuff. It's like Ezekiel seeing glory coming from the east, coming from the Mount of Olives. I kind of recreated the moment there for myself. Yes? No. Well, yes, because the temple's gone. See, I would be where I'm standing right there, I could not, if that is the correct drawing, I could not have stood there as a Gentile. Where you can't go today, where it's sitting right there today, is the Dome of the Rock. And so we can't go into the Dome of the Rock. We could go in there, oh, I don't know how many years, it was 20 years ago or something, but an Orthodox Jew went in a few years ago, strapped with dynamite, and after that time they shut it down. They used to let tourists come in and take pictures and stuff, but they shut it down because they don't want to get blown out. So, but yeah, that whole temple court is just laid bare. It's just pavement. Then 6 and 7, you can see the stairs that go up. And if you understand this, I'm looking at number 10 on the map. And you see those little stairs to hold the gates? There's two gates there. One's a double gate. Another is called the triple gate. But the idea there is those two black squares. Those are as if those stairs, they're down low and you're on the outside of the temple. But you'd go up those stairs, enter into like an escalator. It wasn't an escalator, but think of it as an escalator. Then you'd rise up. You'd have to walk upstairs and come out on the surface. And that's where you would come out on the surface. Well, you can see on pictures 6 and 7, you can see the remains of those stairs. Those are the stairs. Jesus walked on those stairs. There's no doubt about it. Jesus walked on those stairs. Peter and John walked on those stairs. James walked on those stairs. They did. I mean, they were there. That was part of the Temple Mount. In fact, it is very likely that Jesus sat on those stairs and conducted classes. The rabbis recorded Gamaliel. Is recorded. Jesus, or Paul's teacher, is recorded in Jewish writings as sitting on those stairs conducting class. We sat on those stairs while Carl talked to us. And so those stairs in 6 and 7, those are first century Herodian stairs. And then you'd come up there and you'd enter into a gate that's blocked shut. And then you'd go up a series of stairs and come out on the Temple Mount. And you'd go in there. We were on the Temple Mount and we can look down those stairs. You can still see it. You and I, we were joking around. I was going to rush down those stairs and take some pictures, but it'd be the last thing I got. I would have got shot and stuff. But I would have thrown my camera back, and you guys could have had some pictures. But it's easier to just go online and Google a picture than die for it. So I didn't run down those stairs and take pictures. But, I mean, what I'm saying is you could still run down those stairs, and the walls block shut, but it's all still there. There's a lot of stuff there. Okay, number 5. You can see on the Temple Mount right there where number 5 is. There I'm standing at the base of the... And those are Herodian stones there. This is not like, do you think that's where it was? I know that's where it was because those are the stones. They pushed the stones over, but they didn't go all the way down to the ground because as you push stones over, they cover up the lower stones. You're going to have to move, you have to remove the stones so you can get the other ones. And so once you did remove them, and someone would come back later, the Christians came back, the Muslims came and took over, and they'd use those stones and rebuild the walls. And so they just build them right back up. So some of those stones are original Herodian stones from the time that Herod, when they said to Jesus, it's taken 46 years to build this. Those were the stones that they had built. So now what's interesting here is you're standing there at the southeast corner of the Temple Mount looking up, and it's very, very high. In Jesus' day, there would have then been above that a building called the Solomon's Colonnade that would be even above higher. So you could have gone up on top of that and looked down at the top of this wall from on top of a building and then looked down past the wall down into the Kidron Valley. It would have been one of the highest places on the Temple Mount. And when Satan took Jesus to the highest place on the Temple Mount, we don't know exactly. There's three different or four different options of where that would be. This would be one of the candidates right here. That because looking from the top of a building, that would be on top of this wall area, looking down to the Kidron Valley, was a long, long ways. And if Jesus would have jumped, and the angels would, like it says in the text, would not let him dash his foot against the stone, and the angel would have rushed to his rescue, he would have floated down like a butterfly, and everyone would have gone, wow, there's the sign that we were waiting for. And then everyone would have followed him, but of course it would have been completely out of God's plan. It would have been a completely misunderstanding. And now they're following signs instead of following the truth. They would not have understood the light. They would have It would have been revelation, where there's going to be fire going to be called out of heaven, and all, oh, look at the miraculous signs, and everyone's going to follow the deception to their damnation. And Jesus says, no, we're not going to do it that way. But that could be the other place. Now, good question. Go over to 10, just to the other corner. Go over to 10 right there. And that is where, and again, I don't have all the pictures here. You have to get the book. But that is where the trumpeting stone was found. When they destroyed the temple, they pushed. There's a place right there, right where 10's at, where there's a place, because that would be more out towards, you can see 10, 9, or 5, you're kind of looking out towards the Kidron Valley. Where if you go over to 10, now you're out facing the priestly quarters of the city. You understand what I'm saying? This is where the traffic's coming from. So there was, they have it, we found it, and I've taken a picture of it. A place in the wall. They had a railing around the wall, so you're like, oh, I'll fall off the wall. But there's a place right there where it was notched out, and it says right in there in Hebrew, it says from the first set, from 2,000 years ago, it says the place of the trumpeter. And the priest would step up into that spot on the wall and would blare his trumpet for the beginning of the feast, the beginning of the new moons. You know, they'd watch the sun and the moon and all these, you know, the sunrise, sunset, and they'd blow the trumpet to announce, you know, they didn't have, you know, cell phones to tell you what was going on. The trumpet would blare the sound. You'd, oh, the feast has officially begun. That is where James apparently was taken in 63 AD. Jesus' brother was taken there and placed on that very spot. Again, it was most likely that corner. It's assumed that he was probably in a place like that of announcement. And he was told, according to Josephus and others, that he was supposed to proclaim Jesus is not the Christ. He's not the soon coming king. He's a deceiver, and anyone who's following him is deceived. Something to that effect. And he stepped up there and says, Jesus is the Christ. He is the soon coming king. And the Pharisees and the priests didn't like that announcement to the public. And so they pushed him. And he falls down, but he doesn't die. And so they beat him with clubs until he was dead. That's how Jesus' brother James, the pastor of the Church of Jerusalem, dies. He was pushed from that number 10. You can see number 10, that's Robinson's Arch. That's the remains of a bridge that connected there. And there's a gate above that you could go in there. It was like a bridge that would go over the Central Valley and in. You know, there were shops underneath it and stuff. Number 9 was just discovered in 2005. That's the Pool of Siloam. Now, there's places where they record where waters. If you go to an old Bible dictionary that's, you know, from 2006 or before, it's going to have something else. It actually just shows you a water channel that will run into this. But in 2005, while they're doing some excavation work as far as running some sewer, they uncovered that you see the steps going down. It's no doubt about it. This is the Pool of Siloam. Number 11, you can go back over there on the mount. Those are, we were in that gutter right there, Larry. We were underneath those, see those stones that are crushed right there? The reason that was those stones, that's the sidewalk from New Testament times. It's the sidewalk just along the Western Wall sidewalk. When the Romans pushed stones over the walls, they're destroying the temple. That sidewalk caved in. Now, why? And at first, I didn't understand. It took me, you know, a lot of these things you see, you take pictures, you talk about it, but you don't really understand it until later. I began to realize when we were in the underneath those stones, we were in the gutter underneath those stones. And the reason they're caved in like that is because there's nothing underneath them. It's a gutter. It's a runway. It's big enough for us to walk in. And there's stones down in the gutter. I mean, it's not just a tunnel. There's cut stones, rough stones, but they're square, blocking it up. And you look up, you can see the pavement stones from the first century. So when the Romans pushed those stones over and it caved it in, that's why it's crushed like that. It's crushing in the gutter. That's where I climbed over the thing where it says, do not enter, and went further. Yes, exactly. Yes, I got closer to the glory, Larry. No, I could go on and on. There's a stone there from 19 B.C., when they were building that Robinson's Arch in number 10, and it's a really nice ashlar stone. It's all cut square, but it appears that one day on a Friday afternoon, or everybody's kind of getting out, they're tired, they're trying to get home from early from work. Let's hurry, get this done, and get out of here. Whoops, the cable breaks. It crashes down and penetrates, and it goes wedges in as a corner into that pavement, and they covered it up. In 1880, Charles Warren, who was doing a lot of excavation work, said he was doing plumbing work, but he wasn't. He was excavating underneath the city, and he came up and said, well, we're trying to get better water to the city, and they gave him permission, but he's actually down there drawing pictures of what's underneath there. He drew that stone, and it's a perfectly cut stone that doesn't belong there. It clearly fell off the truck or something, or you know, about 19 B.C. So I knew it was there. It was just further up. So I thought, I mean, how many times do you get to be underneath the Temple Mount, you know? So it's like, Larry, take my camera. And I crawled over the fence, and I found it. And quick, take a picture, Larry. And I said, you got a picture of that stone, and I'm underneath it. And anyway, yes, you're correct. I broke a law right there. But I got a cool picture. I saw something. Well, I'll quit. Okay, there's other things here. But anyway, there's the Western Wall. There's one of the Herod's towers, the base where Tony's standing, number 13. That's the base of one of the towers that Herod built. Still got the base. We'll talk about that at some point, maybe. And then the Jebusite Wall, when David took, you go down to number 50 in the Gihon Springs. That's a Jebusite Wall that was built, a retaining wall to kind of hold up that part of the city so they could build a big building on top of it, which was a government building. That was probably the Jebusite's fortress that David took from him, and it became David's palace. He improved it, and it became the royal palace of the kings of Judah, is right above that. So those, in number 15, those stones might date back to easy 1500 B.C., but they're before the time of David. And remember, this is right below those stones, probably where the Gihon Springs is. That's where the king's garden was, where all the water was run down there. And that's probably where Abraham and Melchizedek met when they talked with the king of Sodom Abraham was coming back after defeating Chedorlaomer and the kings from the east. You understand what I'm talking about there. That would be down there in the king's garden. Anyway, my whole point for putting that in there was, and that's like drinking one drip of water out of a garden hose, that right there. There's so much more. And I did not know that stuff was there. I did not know. I got over there. The only thing I kept thinking is, why has no one told me this? I've been in church my whole life, and no one's just got to trust God. Trust God. It's like, there is some evidence that these things are true. There is some history that you don't have to just, well, I don't know. I hope I'm right. It's like, there it is. Again, there is faith. I'm not saying faith isn't involved, obviously, but it's not blind faith. Don't just jump and trust something. Just like James and John and Peter, they knew Jesus. When he says, come follow me, they'd already tested him. They'd already asked him some questions. They knew who they were following. I can quit that. Obviously, I could keep going. Hopefully next week, I'm going to think about where I'm at, what I just got done saying. And then I want to begin the life of Christ and just kind of walk through and weave all the Gospels together. I don't want to take 20 years to do it, but it'd be nice to get through it and kind of weave them together, kind of tell the story. I think it's interesting to see some things that kind of complement each other. I'm going to pray, and then you're free to go. Thank you very much for taking time to be here. Father, we thank you again for the chance to look into your word. We thank you for the things you've preserved for us, that we can trust you, that we know that you are the light of the world, that you are the eternal God. We ask that we'd place our hope in you, that we'd allow ourselves to be transformed into your image, that we might reflect your truth and your life to this world. Not our own goals or our own aspirations, but your truth, Father. Again, we thank you for this opportunity to know you at this time in history, and ask that we may share that information with others. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.